Charlie, Katie, and Chris are all going to get a chance to share a little bit of their story here tonight. They're going to probably speak around 40 minutes each or so. We're going to take a quick little break in between, and then we'd like to welcome you all back tomorrow. We're starting here at 9 o'clock, and we're going to go all the way till the afternoon, and we welcome you all back. And we have a nice little lunch provided tomorrow, too. So I haven't had Charlie's going to start out tonight, and I haven't had a chance to hear Charlie before, but we had a very nice, fun, exciting ride back, so I'm sure you will be in for a very nice, nice, interesting talk. So if you all help me welcome Charlie.
I'm Charlie Parker. I'm a grateful recovered alcoholic. Boy, am I glad to be here. We'll talk a little bit about that, but it could have gone either way. We just spent an hour and a half at the border, and that was it was my fault, and it wasn't bad for me. The last time I was at the border, I got arrested. So an hour and a half was pretty good time for us, except for Chris was still working on breakfast. About 3 o'clock, he started getting a little grumpy. But we're real happy to be here. My sobriety date is March 22nd of 1985, and that is the most important thing that ever happened in my life. My home group is the Primary Purpose Group in Austin, Texas. And we would welcome you. If you find yourself in Austin, Texas on a Tuesday night, come see us. We think it's a terrific meeting. We usually have about 150 to 175 people on Tuesday night studying the big book, line by line, word by word. We've been doing it. We just had our fourth anniversary, and we're on our third pass through the book. We're going to roll into. We just did the hour this week, and we're going to do 6 and 7 next week. So that's how far we are into our third pass. So it's really been fun, and I love the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous. I love the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I love any time I get a chance to get up and talk about what we do here in AA and what's happened to us and stuff. I want to thank Ron for asking us to come up here. It's a real honor. I mean, as Chris and I had the same sponsor, and Chris was with Mark a lot longer than I was. But the 4 years that I spent with him, I haven't made it through a talk yet talking about Mark since he died, but it was a very formative 4 years for me. And we miss Mark a great deal, but Chris was supposed to do this thing with Mark, and those are big shoes to fill, so they brought both of us, and I still don't know if we can do it, but I miss Mark. I love Mark, but Ron asked us to come up here, and then Marcus picked us up at the airport. I don't think he knew what he was getting into. But he did a fine job of driving us up here, and thank God he was in a rental car, because when I looked back and they were pulling his back seat out and had a guy on a creepy crawly underneath it and they were ripping the dash out, I'm like, I'm glad you came in a rental, Marcus. Welcome to Charlie Parker. Now, was that 6:20 by that clock? What does it say right now? 6:25? Katie's really worried about how long I'm going to go tonight. She's got 40 minutes and I've got 40 minutes. But, in Texas with community property law, the way I see it, we got 80 minutes between us, So I really hope we get to hear from Katie tonight. The last time Katie was speaking in Vancouver one time, and I'm going to try to give the shortest version of this story I've ever given, but she was speaking in Vancouver, a little over a year ago, and we got to the airport, and they wouldn't let her get on with the little plastic card. They said, you have to drive across with that. So I'm think, and then I go, well, fly us to Seattle. It's only like an hour from Seattle to Vancouver, right? And well, it's like a 4-hour death march from Seattle to Vancouver. But we drive, and when we get to the border, this is the first time I've ever had it on me. I pull out my passport in this groovy little leather case that I carried in because I'm a big deal, you know. And and I hand the lady my case in the little booth, and she pulls it out of the case, and she holds it up, and she looks at the document page, and she goes, "You're handing me a Korean passport with your picture in it?" And I go, "What?" You know, and that's when it all started. You know, I mean, she slams that window shut like, you know, they surround us like SWAT team. They pull us out of the car. You know, they're badgering me with questions. I don't know what to, you know, I don't know whether to answer this question or listen to that question. And at one point, the guy goes, "Your story is weak." And I'm like, "Oh, it damn sure is. I mean, I got no story, you know. I mean, you know, I've run a few scams. I'd have a better story than this, you know." But I mean, but you know, long story short, it appears that someone had stolen my passport at some point and copied it on a color copier machine, cut that document page out. I hope I'm not giving anybody any ideas. Glued that document page into a worthless Korean passport, stuck it back in my little leather case, stuck it back in my briefcase, and made off with my U.S. passport. And you know, and it's till I walk up to the Canadian border like a dope and hand them this Korean passport. And so, I mean, it took almost 5 months working through the United States Senator's office to get myself another passport because I don't have a sterling background, you know. Today was the first time we've tried to use it since I got the new one, and you know, I hadn't signed it yet, and then we get to the border, and she's, you know, wanting to know about my arrest record, and I'm like, "Well, it's not as bad as it looks, you know. Most of those, I was, you know, managed to get not guilty or deferred adjudication or something, but." You know, and as alcoholics, am I the only one that has a sense of entitlement? I mean, there's a part of me that wants to go, "Come on, that arrest was 36 years ago, you know, and they don't care, you know." So we were there an hour and a half, and it looked like everything was going pretty good. And then she goes, "Mr. Parker, come back in." And I walk back in, and she goes, "Korean passport?" I'm like, "Oh. I was really hoping you didn't hear that part, you know." And so I had to tell her the whole story. But anyway, we're here, and we're darn glad to be here. We're going to each talk a little bit. You know, and I'm really looking forward to this weekend. Chris is a good friend of ours, and he's been one of my heroes for a long time. I mean, you know, when I was in middle of the road AA, Chris spoke to me, and, you know, I come from a Southern Baptist background. You can just bring it as hard as you want to a guy like me. I respond to that, and a lot of what he was talking about. And then, you know, eventually winding up in the lineage with Mark Houston and some of those guys, there's a lot of good AA there. And in the past 7 or 8 years, you know, we've really been finding, you know, there's pockets of enthusiasm all around, you know, London, Ontario, and Louisville, Kentucky, and, you know, just wherever you go, there are always little. It's funny because I had just had a sponsee move to Houston. He's a good boy. He's one of my best guys. And I said, "Get down there and go, where do those kind of annoying, a little over the top big book thumpers go, you know?" And that's because that's where you're going to want to wind up, you know? And they can usually tell you, but that hadn't always been my experience. And I hope that's a lot of what we get a chance to talk about this, you know, because, well, how many people in the room have, say, less than 6 months of sobriety? Excellent. Okay. And how many have over 10 years? Wow. Fantastic. Fantastic. It's a funny time in AA, and, you know, I'm going to talk a little bit about what it was like, you know, what happened. Not much, though. I mean, but we are supposed to be telling our stories tonight, and I mean, I literally ran right from the car, and where's my man Kevin? He saw me in my underwear in the bathroom, and I was like, you know, do I pray while I'm, you know, getting dressed, or, you know, it's all good, you know. We could still be at the border. I grew up in Dallas, Texas. I grew up in a pretty normal family, if there is such a thing, you know. I mean, I really like the saying that normal is a setting on a washing machine, but it was normal enough, you know. There wasn't any real obvious dysfunction in our house. Nobody was drinking. Nobody was knocking each other around. You know, I've heard a lot of fifth steps over the years, and I've heard enough to know that I had it pretty good growing up. I mean, it was a pretty normal household. I grew up under the burden. Anybody else grew up under the burden of potential? Anybody? Oh, my God. I mean, that was like all I heard about was, you know, why can't you live up to your potential? Why can't you be more like, you know, Charles Mellier across the street, you know? And I just remember thinking, it's flattering, Mom, but I'm really not holding back that much, you know? I mean, this is you're kind of getting my best shot here, you know. But my mother was a first grade school teacher for 42 years, and I was well prepared for the first grade. I kind of kicked ass, you know, all the way up to maybe fifth grade, you know. But you know, it was a normal. Except my sister was perfect. I had one of those sisters. She's 5 years older. She was all everything. You know, she was drum majorette, first chair flute player, National Honor Society, you name it, you know. And then she's got this thuggish little brother. But I think it was a lot easier to just kind of scale it off and go the other way. But, I mean, I was getting, you know, all the stuff they were saying not to do, I couldn't wait to do. And, you know, and I was always, they used to talk about high IQ and stuff like that. When you say that to a self-centered alcoholic, budding alcoholic, what I hear is a free pass, you know, and you're not going to have to do anything, and you get a free pass. And a lot of us in the room know that a high IQ or whatever they called it back then will get you a front row seat in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. It won't do much to keep you sober, but I'm going through all this stuff, and, you know, whatever happened in my growing up, I know a lot of us, it's funny, a lot of us get to AA and we try to figure out, why am I an alcoholic? You know, what happened to me to make me an alcoholic? And none of that stuff made me an alcoholic. None of the stuff that happened to me growing up, none of the stuff that didn't happen to me growing up had to do with me being an alcoholic. And I like to talk about it. We hope to talk about it some this weekend. I spent a lot of time in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, even raising my hand saying, my name's Charlie, I'm an alcoholic, and I had no idea what it meant. You know, I knew that I drank all the time, and I drank every day, and everybody, you know, my mother used to shake her finger at me and go, you drink, she had a way of moving just the finger, and she'd go, you drink every day. And I remember thinking, everybody I know drinks every day, Mom. You know, I mean, if you know, and, well, I learned a lot more about that later, but I didn't really know what it meant to be alcoholic. I knew I had problems because of drinking. I'd been in a lot of trouble because of drinking. I'd lost the jobs and the cars and the girlfriends and that sort of thing. But that, some of that stuff, you know, happens to people that aren't alcoholic. And I mean, that happens to people that drink a lot. And so, you know, what is it? I mean, because I started drinking pretty young. And, you know, on page 30, it says we learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholic. It says it's the first step in recovery. Well, if I'm going to, there's a lot going on in that sentence. That's what I love about the primary purpose group format, is that breaking it down and looking at what it really means. And when I say fully concede to my innermost self that I'm alcoholic, first of all, I best know what it means to be alcoholic if I'm going to fully concede to it, and not just up here in my head. What does it really mean to be alcoholic? You know, and I really didn't know. I started drinking when I was 16 years old. You know, it's funny. I'm 53 years old. I've been sober 25 years. Katie's got 5 months on me. She'll never let me live it down. Katie and I have quite a history. I hope to talk about that. The other thing I got to warn you, if we're going to be here all weekend, I got a little scatterbrain working up here, you know, and sometimes my brain is, we talked about ADHD on the way here with Ron, but whatever it is, sometimes when I say I'm going to get back to that later, that means this isn't the right time to talk about it in the talk. But when I tell you we're going to come back to it later, we're probably not coming back. You know? It's about a 5% chance we're going to pull it back around. I'm always so excited when I pull it back. But I used to think that 16 was really early to get started drinking, you know? And now it's not even young to stop at 16, you know? I mean, you know, we got people coming in, you know, and I'm not busting on anybody. You know, much love for the young people in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't start drinking until I was 16, though, and I probably didn't need this program until I was about 17. You know, so I had a little while where it was going pretty good, and by 17 I was way into outside substances and outside issues. And Ron said this isn't officially an AA meeting, but I just my training is not to talk about outside issues in AA meetings. But let's just say I had deep experience with outside issues. You know? You know, there was, to my knowledge, I didn't miss anything that was available when I was qualifying for this program. And you know, and it's funny, this isn't everybody's story in AA, and it'd be real macho to stand up here and say that I drank a fifth of whiskey from the time I was 16 till I sobered up at 28. That wouldn't be true. But what I can tell you, and this isn't true for everybody in Alcoholics Anonymous, a lot of people held it together a lot better than I did, but for me, I never turned down the opportunity to get loaded one time under any circumstances, under any conditions. There never one time. There was never one time where I went, oh, gee, thanks, but it's, you know, it's my mom's birthday or something like that. I didn't have it, you know, but I started somewhere around 17, 18 years old. I crossed some kind of an invisible line, and I don't know when it was. I think that's why we call it an invisible line, but, you know, I lost the power of choice and control somewhere around that age, and you know, the book talks on page 44 about when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely, or if when you start drinking, you have little control over the amount you take, you're probably alcoholic. That's one of only really a couple of places in the book where it diagnoses alcoholism. But in the doctor's opinion, it says men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. Any argument on that one? You know, I mean, I've always felt like that was a little understated. You know, I like banana pudding, you know, but I loved the effect produced by alcohol. You know, I mean, I didn't just burn my whole world to the ground over something I just kind of dig a little bit. You know, I mean, it did something for me that I didn't even know I needed. It relieved a problem that I didn't even know I had, you know, and I'd been carrying around a feeling of difference and separation and a little bit less than since about the fifth grade. And you know, that to me, that's as close as I've ever been able to come to describing the spiritual malady, is that feeling of separation, that hole that you hear so many people in Alcoholics Anonymous talk about. But and when the first time I drank, it did something for that, and I'm, you know, I remember thinking immediately, we are going to do this a lot, you know, and I started paying a tremendous price for it, but I was kept trying to make it work like it did when I was 18, 19 years old, you know, and I mean, it started getting, you know, you go for a long time and it's good, and then you start having it's pretty good, but some negative stuff, and then lots of negative stuff, and then it's just kind of all negative towards the end. But in my delusional mind, I'm still thinking that one day it's going to be like it was when I was 18, 19 years old again, you know, and I had that mix where it was just right. And I would always overshoot the mark a little bit, you know, and wreck the car and stuff, you know, and AA was the first place I'd ever been around people that drank like I drank and understood what drinking did for me. Because when my mother would say, you know, you drink too much, I wouldn't have even been able to formulate it in words, but I would have said, you know, look, Mom, I can see from where you're sitting it probably looks like I drink a lot, and, you know, and maybe I do, you know, and sometimes I overshoot the mark and I wreck the car and I lose the girlfriend or I get thrown in jail or I spend the whole paycheck or something like that. But if you understood what drinking does for me, you wouldn't be saying stupid crap to me like, you know, like you need to stop drinking. Because at some level, I knew drinking, you know, was my solution. It looked like my problem, but it was what I was using to treat my problem. And it started getting really sloppy there for a while. One night I left a bar in a blackout, and I'd had five Long Island teas, and is that a universal drink? Long Island. Okay, well that's a lot. There was a crash, and I could see a fender sticking up. My field of vision was only about this big. I could see a fender sticking up, and we're still rolling. So I kept my foot on the gas, and I drove around the corner and jumped out, grabbed my shoes, and I'm running back to the bar to report the car stolen. And you know, obviously there's been a car theft, and this is not an extraordinary night. You know, this is just Charlie rolling. You know, and so I call it in, and the next morning they call me and they go, Mr. Parker, you're going to have to come take a polygraph test before you get your car back. And I said, well, why is that? And they said, well, it was involved in an accident before. I forgot this piece of the story. As I'm running back to the bar with my shoes in my hand, across the street are two cops standing out there in the street. And I can remember their flashlight tinkling off all this glass that's in the street. And in my altered state, I still remember thinking, my God, they got here fast. You know, I mean, how did they get here so fast? And when they called me and said, you're going to have to take a polygraph test, I said, why? And they said, well, it was in an accident before it was reported stolen. I said, really? And they said, yeah, they ran into a parked police car. And I remember thinking, that explains how they got there so fast. You know, because I'd been a little foggy on you know, how they, I mean, they were there like that, you know, and, but I mean, Norm Alpie used to talk about how our lives were saved and changed by seconds and inches, and I had a lot of stories like that where my, you know, the Canadian border could have said, oh, hell no, you know, I mean, if they'd have seen the record of what I should have been arrested for, because it was like that all the time. I mean, it was just, you know, getting out of a deal. And if those two cops had been standing there when I rolled down the street, you know, I could still be in jail, you know, for running over a couple of cops. But, you know, I started losing the power of choice. And control. Somewhere along the line, I could choose whether or not I was going to get loaded, and I couldn't control how much I was going to drink when I started drinking. And now we're getting into the definition of alcoholism. You know, turns out there's two things that make me alcoholic. One is what happens to me when I drink it, and one is what happens to me when I don't drink it. And other than that, I got a pretty good handle on drinking. But the thing that happens to me when I drink it is it triggers that phenomenon of craving. When I take a drink, I can't guarantee when I'm going to stop or how it's going to go with any predictability. And then it goes on further, you know, to say, and the book talks a whole lot about that. The first 23 pages of the book and most of the doctor's opinion talks about that physical craving that triggers. But then it says that wouldn't mean anything if I didn't ever take the first drink. And that's that second part, is that I get so miserable when I'm not drinking that I'm going to drink again. And, you know, so when we talk about recovering from a hopeless condition of mind and body, the way that rolls out when it gets fully developed in a guy like me is I'm so uncomfortable when I stay sober or when I try to. My problem wasn't that I couldn't stop drinking. I couldn't stop starting. You know, every time I'd stop drinking, I'd eventually start drinking again. And the weird thing about it, that thing about that phenomenon of craving, every time I ever took that first drink that triggered that phenomenon of craving, I was stone cold sober. That's kind of one of the baffling parts of alcoholism, is I make the craziest decision in my life, the decision to take another run at it, even though I have zero evidence to prove that this is going to go well. I make that decision stone cold sober because I get so uncomfortable not drinking. You know, so when you get stuck in that cycle, the book calls it the terrible cycle. And the way it rolls out for a guy like me is once it's fully developed in a guy like me, I'm going to drink until I have to stop. And then I'm going to stop until I have to drink. And that's the terrible cycle that the book talks about. And it goes down. So for the new guys in the room, if you don't take anything away other than what it means to be an alcoholic and the nature of alcoholism, that is huge. Because when that's fully established in a guy like me, my first job in step one when I'm working with a new guy, and we'll talk about this a lot tomorrow, is to give this guy a fatal dose of alcoholism. I need to understand in here that on my own power, I got no shot, period. Absolutely no shot. But when I talk about the power of choice and control, I like to talk about the pawn shops because I loved pawn shops. I mean, I loved the whole theory, the whole equation of it was just so pure, you know, that, I mean, you would walk in there and say, you know, here's my shotgun. Well, I should also say that another big key to this is that, well, I'll get to that in just a second, but you never walk in there and hand them the shotgun and they go, good God, man, what are you going to do with this money, you know, or weren't you just here this morning, or, you know, something like that, you know, it never happens, you know, you hand them the deer rifle and they give you the money and out you go, and then you come back with the coin collection and the only problem with this equation, and you had 90 days to get everything out of the pawn shop, you know, before they sold it. The only one problem with this equation, I should say, is that I didn't own very much stuff. So I was always pawning stuff that didn't belong to me. Katie thinks it's an important part of the police car story to say that it was my mother's car that I wrecked. I wrecked every car my mother ever owned. And I was so poorly treated as a child growing up that I finally ran away from home for good at the age of 27. I'm not kidding. Never went back. I had some apartments in there, but I'd always wind up back on their couch, you know. And I was real hard on my folks, and so there's a lot of their stuff that I'm pawning. And you know, when we talk about the loss of choice and control, are there any Al-Anons here? Okay, all right. Well, I want to say in advance, there's parts of this story that we know aren't funny. I mean, some of it I have to tell it like it's a joke. Because the level of powerlessness that we walk around with is devastating. And I didn't know when I got here why, when I would promise people that I'm not going to do this anymore, I'd keep doing it, you know. So with this pawn shop thing, you know, drunks make good plans. We make just brilliant plans, and they work right up till they don't work anymore, you know. And the plan with this was I had 3 months to get everything out of the pawn shop. And, you know, and then you could kind of roll again. And I could usually pull a scam every 3 months to get everything. Except for this one night, I got an insurance claim, and I just stopped in for a couple of drinks. I didn't know that by stopping in there, I was triggering a phenomenon of craving and that I had no control over what was about to happen. But what happened was I was a blackout drinker a lot. Katie wasn't. I was. But this was a five-day blackout. 5 days, don't remember anything except for one incident where a friend of mine got cut. Other than that, I don't remember anything in the rest of that 5 days. And I came out of this blackout, and I had $8 and all those pawn tickets. And, you know, those mornings where you just go, oh, no. You know, you know, if you're an alcoholic and you're sitting in this room, you know those mornings, you know, where you just go, I shot my wad, you know, I put everything I had into getting that other little scam, and now I've blown the money, and what are we going to do now? And I would have to go to my father and say, Dad, if we act now, this is the part that I said we know isn't funny. I'd say, if we act now, I can get you a really good deal on all your stuff. But if we wait till tomorrow, it's strictly retail, you know. So the point of this story is, when we talk about the loss of choice and control, this was in Dallas, Texas. I grew up in Dallas. I live in Austin, Texas now. We would get in the car, and it wasn't like you're just going to go to the pawn shop. It was, you know, we had to get in the car. And Dallas is a big, sprawling, spread-out city, not a urban vertical type city. It's like LA in that it's real wide and low. So it wasn't like we're just going to go to the pawn shop. It was like we got to go around Garland Road and get your deer rifle, and we got to go to Buckner Boulevard and get the shotgun, and then your coin collection's out on East Grand, and then the metal detectors are on Beltline Road, and the Sterling Silver's over in Oak Cliff, and we got to go to Garland. So it was all day in the car with me and my dad and all this shame. You know, just it's all over you, you know. And I mean, I knew enough to know that this wasn't right. My dad was a good man. Nobody was giving him his stuff. And here I am, you know, out there pawning it. The reason this story is important about loss of choice and control is because when we would be riding in that car, I would be saying, "Dad, I swear to God, I will never do this again." And if I was lying to that guy, I damn sure didn't know it, because it felt like I meant it with every fiber of my being, that I will never, ever do this again. I'll never put you through this again. I don't ever want to be like this again. What I didn't know was that I didn't have the power to make good on that promise. By telling him I wasn't going to do this again, I might as well have been promising him that I was going to flap my arms and fly up around the back of the room and come back and land at this podium, because I did not have the power to make good on that promise. That's what we're talking about when we talk about the loss of choice and control. If you're a person that can make up your mind to stop drinking and pull it off, you don't even belong in a program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous is for people like me that swear to God, this time I mean business, and I drink again. Because within 2 or 3 days, I'd hit the back door of his house like a cat burglar, and it'd be off and again. And my dad and I made the rounds of the pawn shops 3 times before I eventually sobered up. Well, 25, 25, 35. Okay, I still got a little time. That's what we're talking about when we talk about, you know, the loss of choice and control and a hopeless condition of mind and body, is that I get so uncomfortable when I try to stay sober that I'm going to drink again eventually. Restless, irritable, and discontent. You know, the doctor's opinion that does a brilliant job of laying this stuff out in the first 43 pages of the big book, and the doctor's opinion are pretty much devoted to step one, because we're not going anywhere until I got that in here. Not up here. But in here where I go, my God, what if I am a garden variety alcoholic? What if I, you know, the way you're describing this stuff is explaining a lot of stuff that I've never been able to explain before. You know, like when people would say, "Why'd you start drinking again?" I gave them the only answer any of us have, which is what? I don't know. That's what I do, you know. Now I know. But, I mean, I tell you, it still doesn't make your family feel a lot better, you know, if they go, "Why'd you start drinking?" And go, "Well, it's like this, Mom. I have a spiritual malady that's it's driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity." You know, it creates a mental obsession in me that makes me powerless over the first drink. And when I take the first drink, that makes me powerless over the second. And Mom, I actually have a hopeless condition of mind and body. And, you know, that's why I pawned your television set. But it damn sure helped me to know it, you know, because until we have this common problem, we're not going to be interested in the common solution. We all get here a little unique. And a lot of us as newcomers, I used to think that I could break this deal down for the new guy and we'd all get it and lock elbows and trudge the road of happy destiny together. I forgot that most of us are sitting there going, I don't have it like that. I don't have it like you got it. If I had it like you've got it, I'd work your stupid little 12-step thing or whatever it is. But, I mean, I think when I get out of here, I can still tweak this deal a little bit and make it work. You know, I know it looks bad right now because I'm in detox and stuff, but I really, you know, it's not as bad as it looks. I got this, you know, and that's what we will ride into the graveyard. The book talks about, you know, it's present in us a long time before most of us suspect it. But there's something that happens on that day when I have that, what we call a step one experience, where all of a sudden I go, hold on just a minute. What you're saying is explaining a lot of stuff I've never, because Clancy likes to say, if you gave every one of us a flag to wave when we're coming new, all of our flags would say the same thing. It'd say, you don't understand, my case is different. You know? But there's something that happens when all of a sudden I go, what if I'm just a garden variety alcoholic? You know, then the common solution becomes available to me, and we can get something done. You know, when we're doing the steps and stuff tomorrow, we're going to break it down into the problem, the solution, and the program of action. They're three critical things, but I'm not going to be interested in the solution to a problem I don't think I have. Does that make sense? It'd be like going to PTA meetings when I don't have any children. You know, it's just. Why would I do that? You know, but the moment that I really think I'm one of y'all, this deal gets really interesting. You know, there's a friend of mine likes to say that I know two things about AA that I didn't know when I got here, and that is that I was in a lot more trouble than I thought I was when I got here, and the other is that AA had a lot bigger answer than I was giving them credit for. You know, I really thought I had a little bit of a problem and that maybe we could just tweak things just a little bit and it'd be all right. But AA's got a big answer for a huge problem. And, you know, one of the things I hope we get around to talking about, you know, is that my first pass in AA, I didn't understand the problem. I really thought the problem was alcohol. And I went through the sponsor, and we went through the steps, and I mean, it's funny, when I read the book, I like to look for things that I agree with. Anybody, I guess I'm the only one like that, right? You know, I like to read and look for things that I already agree about, you know, and that's why we work so much with the set-aside prayer, because sometimes I'll just say, help me set aside everything I think I know about this stuff, and let me see the truth, because otherwise I'll sit there and I go, oh yeah, I got that underlined and highlighted. You know, you can't. But when I do the little set aside prayer, all of a sudden stuff starts showing up, and I can see things, you know, outside of what I already. Otherwise, I'm just looking for stuff that I already agree with. You know, I'm looking for evidence that I'm already right. You know, and I can't. We're not going anywhere like that. But I've got a few minutes left to say. I spent quite a few years in AA acting like the problem was alcohol. I didn't know it. I didn't know that I was in fellowship-based Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know that I was middle of the road. I didn't know that I was, had a misunderstanding of the steps. You know, I spent a good deal of time in untreated alcoholism and didn't know it. And it's funny, I have a problem sometimes with judging people really harshly for not knowing something that I learned about 30 minutes ago. I know that happens in Texas. I'm sure it doesn't happen in Canada. But you know, I'll get a new understanding of this stuff, and next thing you know, I'm going, did you hear him in the meeting, for God's sakes? You know, I mean, he's killing newcomers. You know, but I mean, I spent a lot of time in this stuff, and my first pass through the steps, I really thought that the problem was alcohol, and God's going to help me with it. I wasn't really down with God, but then I did an inventory. You know, one of the big problems that I see, and we'll talk about this a lot more tomorrow, is if taking a guy right from "Are you willing to believe" to getting him on his knees and doing a third step prayer. And I had no idea what that huge body of work that takes place on pages 60 to 63. There's no way I'm going to have time to talk about this tonight. We'll try to talk about it tomorrow. But just to fast forward, I had a plane crash in 2003 where we crashed into the water at night and out on Eastern Long Island and had to escape from an underwater plane, and we're on CNN and everything. It was very dramatic. I mean, there's no Earl Hightower story, but it was pretty darn dramatic, you know. And I started looking at things a lot differently, and I realized that at 17 years of sobriety, I was so self-centered that I couldn't even really be involved in a conversation with anybody. Because I didn't care, you know. I would have to force myself to go, "How are the kids?" You know, and act like I give a flip about the answer, you know, because I got me on me like that, you know. So when I'm reading the book, and I come across that line now where it says the first in step three, where it says the first requirement is that we be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. I was like, where did that come from? I mean, because not only was I not convinced of that, that line had never touched me. I mean, when I talk about this huge, the book takes a huge right turn on page 60, and I missed it for a long, long time in the fellowship as a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I didn't know what the real problem was. So when it talks about selfishness, self-centeredness is the root of our problem, above everything, we got to get rid of this selfishness. I mean, it's, you know, that's where Mark Houston just lit us on fire. And I really wish he could be here this weekend to talk to you all about it. But I mean, this level of, you know, seeing now that the problem never really was alcohol, that alcohol was what I found that would soothe the pain of a life based completely on self-centeredness. And it always reminds me, and I'll try to close with it, but I'm a Dallas Cowboy fan. I'm sure. All right. I can't believe that. I didn't expect that. But I spent 20 years going to Dallas Cowboys games and sitting, you know, and I've loved them since I was a kid, since they were good, you know. We've died 1,000 deaths since Troy Aikman retired. But, you know, I'd always go to these Cowboy games. And then a couple of years ago, I had this sponsee that says, "Hey, you know," he goes, "my family's got a skybox at Texas Stadium." He goes, "You want to go watch the Philadelphia game in the skybox?" And I went, "Absolutely!" we drive up there, and we park in a little private parking lot, and we go in through this private entrance, and you go up this civilized little escalator, and you go into a civilized little hallway, and it's all real quiet, and you know, you go into the room, and they're bringing buckets of ice and trays of cookies and stuff, and I didn't know whether to be excited about being in a skybox or be pissed about sitting in the cheap seats for 20 years, but that's the way my experience was with Alcoholics Anonymous. I spent 17 years in AA thinking I was doing AA. And I find out later that there's people doing it at a whole nother level that I'd never even dreamed of, you know. And so, I mean, that's what we get so excited about coming and talking about. I had no idea. If I'd have died in that plane crash on July 20th of 2003, I would have missed it. I almost missed it anyway. If you'd have come to me at 17 years of sobriety and said, "Charlie, what is going to change your life and set you on fire is the program of Alcoholics Anonymous right out of the big book," I would have told you were crazy, because I'd been in AA for a long time. I thought I knew what AA had to offer me, you know. So the experience that we've had over the past 7 or 8 years, my God, I mean, I had no idea it was there. And, you know, now, you know, Katie will try to talk about it. She's a lot more centered and focused than I am. But you know, she sponsors about 25 girls. I'm sponsoring about 15 guys. We're going out she goes to the women's treatment. I go to the men's treatment center. She has a Monday night meeting at the house with her girls. I have a Thursday night meeting at the house with my guys that Mark Houston came to every Thursday night for 4 years. I mean, there was never one time where he walked in that house and I took it for granted. Every time he'd walk in there, I knew this is really awesome, you know, to have Mark coming into the house every Thursday night. And the best AA I've ever been involved in was sitting at that kitchen table with 10 or 12 of us, you know, sitting there talking about AA, you know, the depth and the level of the understanding of the book. And, you know, it's just like, the first time I was ever around Mark, it was just like, what book is he reading from? You know, I mean, because, I mean, I'm seeing stuff that it sounded like it's coming from a book I'd never read before. So, I'm real excited to be here. I love the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you know, I'm real anxious to say it. This is the short. I actually just ran right from the car to the podium, so I'm really looking forward to sitting down here and what Katie's got to say. Katie and I we have a very interesting history. We were litter mates in AA. We both came in at the same time, and we were like brother and sister for 20 years. She was like my kid sister, and she was married the whole time, and her husband passed away, and we became a couple about 7 years ago, and we've been married less than 9 months, but she's the best thing that's ever happened to me, and she really works a rock-solid AA program, and I'm looking forward to hearing her talk, and we're real happy to be here. Thanks for listening.